Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, president and founder of SMIE Consulting. And today we'll be taking a look at three issues in this week's international ed news that crossed our feeds. And we'll take an in-depth look on a couple of these issues that we've talked about before, particularly with regards to the Confucius Institutes in the United States, and also regarding Education USA and the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and what's happening with those. So we'll take a look at those in just a minute, and I want to say thank you to all of you who have joined us before or who are joining us for the first time. It's really a pleasure to be connecting with you each Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we look forward to talking about these issues and getting your feedback, because not just talking about the issues, but also taking a deeper dive into how these issues might be impacting your institution and what you might be able to do to modify your existing policies or perhaps adapt to new policies that might help improve what you do internationally. So we'll be talking about all these and more. And before we do, for those of you who are not familiar with SMIE Consulting, it's social media and international education consulting. And we run a variety of services, free services, as well as paid services that you can subscribe to on our SMIE Consulting website. But I do want to let everybody know that the stories that I bring to the table each Wednesday come from our e-newsletter that comes out Monday mornings. And that's called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. And I'll take a sampling of stories from that each week and bring those to the table here for this midweek roundup and go a little bit deeper than what social media allows us to do with a simple post. And I've put the link to this week's most recent edition of the SMIE Consulting e-news, all the SMIE News Fit to Share, in the comments section on our Facebook page. So do feel free to check those out. If you haven't already subscribed, I definitely encourage that. I've also posted the link to our SMIE Consulting website where all these services, the free and the paid services, are explained in detail, as well as the archive of these midweek roundups that can be found on our YouTube channel. But you can also podcast this weekly chat on your favorite podcast subscription service. Free, of course, on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, and also Spotify. So hopefully you can connect with us in multiple ways. So those on our website and our newsletter will be useful resources to you moving forward. And I'll also just show you what those look like on the podcast and the website so you have that for future reference. Now, as we go forward today, we'll start with the Confucius Institutes. Now, we've covered this issue on the weekly chat before, but I bring it up again today because there's two new reports that have come out, U.S. Reports that have come out that Inside Higher Ed focused on this past week. And one is from the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, and a second is from the GAO, General Accounting Office. The Inside Higher Ed story certainly talks about those two reports, talks about the oversight or lack thereof that institutions have with regards to what the Confucius Institutes do. They're funded in part by Hanban, that's the Chinese quasi-governmental agency that oversees a variety of things. But has membership from all government officials, so it's pretty much a government body, and according to The Economist, calls it definitely a government entity. And the Chinese language title is the Office of Chinese Language Council International, Hanban, as we've come to know it here in the U.S. Now that Hanban has resources from the Chinese government that help set up these Confucius and run these Confucius Institutes, but the U.S. Institutions where they're located at more than 90 U.S. campuses have Confucius Institutes. We've talked in the past how 10 of them are in the process, at least 10 are in the process of closing, probably near 13 or so, because of various issues related to autonomy and oversight and unilateral control that the Kanban and Confucius Institutes have over what they do. So that's and now that we see the not only this GAO report, but also you see the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations getting involved, then it's starting to raise some red flags. And there's even talk in both the Inside Higher Ed report, as well as a separate story in the Chronicle of Higher Education related to how these Hanban programs through Confucius Institutes may be forcibly closed. And that's a bit troubling when you think about what the investment that's been created by universities and the Chinese partner institutes when they've been set up. So it's interesting to see where that's going to go. Ranjit, thank you for joining me. I hope you are well, and looking forward to your contributions as they're appropriate throughout the course of the chat. So with regard to the Confucius Institutes, you look at the Chronicle of Higher Ed reports on this, and they talk about both the GAO report as well as the Senate subcommittee report. But they're looking, the FBI, obviously, there's been past stories about this, that they're watching warily what the Confucius Institutes are doing, and the security officials that are involved and Chinese government officials that are involved in these programs. What we're also seeing is the other side of the coin, and that there's concerns that these Confucius Institutes aren't abiding by law and are getting away with it. And that, first time I've heard of this, certainly, and it certainly makes sense given what we know about a lot of Chinese government operations and their efforts to control media to their people, and topics of Tiananmen Square, Taiwan, the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in the northwest, and how those minority groups are treated. Tibet obviously is an issue. Those are oftentimes verboten at these Confucius Institutes in terms of topics of discussion, at least in terms of how they're talked about. Certainly, the Western view is oftentimes never allowed. So, what's as part of the programming? So, what has happened is in 2010. The State Department has provided grants in China to founding what they call 29 American cultural centers in China since 2010. Spent over $5.1 million in grants to that effect. And in 4 years, according to this Chronicle article, the State Department recorded 80 instances of Chinese government interference in the center's operations, according to the subcommittee's reports. And those that did open faced a number of concerns from American academics, according to the Chronicle article, about what could be taught there. We talked about what that meant about Tiananmen Square and other topics like that. So we are seeing now that these are going to become very important issues for the Senate committee, and could be potentially affecting U.S.-China relationships. So we'll see where that goes down the road. But it's not just the U.S. that's having issues with this, interestingly enough. You think it's always just us. But we see also a recent Times Higher Ed article talking about a new report there from the Conservative Party. That's the governing party in U.K. right now. Conservative Party Human Rights Commission report calls for investigations into whether, and this is the title, into whether communist-supported centers are being used to intimidate students or restrict freedom of expression. So again, seeing some similar issues there, perhaps not intimidate students. I don't know if we've had occurrences of that at Confucius Institutes in the United States, but certainly in the UK there's been issues, apparently. And this Conservative Party report began its inquiry last year, after similar investigations were launched here in the U.S. by the FBI, that they did find freedom of expression and academic freedom limited, even suppressed, in Confucius Institutes. Right now, there are worldwide Confucius Institutes, much like the Chinese government's soft power initiatives to build relationships through infrastructure investments, other things like that in countries around the world, particularly in South Asia and Africa. You see that happening regularly. You were now at a position where you're looking at the Chinese government and influence through these Confucius Institutes, where there have been actually 27 universities worldwide that have closed, are in the process or have closed ties with Confucius Institutes, including some prominent institutions, Stockholm University, Copenhagen Business School in Europe, University of Chicago, prominently in the United States, and McMaster's University in Canada. So in the UK right now, the Confucius Institutes aren't nearly as widespread as they are in the US, with 90 plus here. In the UK, apparently University College London, University of Manchester, and the University of Sheffield are the primary ones in the UK. So I'm not talking about huge influence there, but per capita, perhaps significant as well. So with respect, the British report also looks at the same kind of issues about, without exception, the comment is that every submission to the commission pointed to serious concerns about the presence of Confucius Institutes and universities in the UK and showed widespread evidence of a ban on the topics of Tibet, Taiwan, and Tiananmen Square. So that's certainly a similar story to what's happened in the United States, and it'll be interesting to track just where that goes in the weeks and months to come. So moving on to our second story. We'll look to one of my favorite topics, and that's the U.S. Department of State. At a recent conference in New York, celebrating at the IIE Summit, the Institute of International Education, an organization I had the privilege of working at for 6 years during my time working with Education USA. IIE is celebrating its 100th year after its forming in 1919, right at the end of World War I, and has had just an outstanding track record since that time of supporting international education. But at this event, the IIE Summit, the Assistant Secretary of State for Educational and Cultural Affairs, that's the bureau at the State Department in which Education USA is housed, as well as the newly created study abroad branch within the last 3 or 4 years. That bureau is chiefly responsible for the State Department's international education policy. And the Assistant Secretary of State, Marie Royce, has made a couple headlines for herself in the last few months. You might remember in December she attended Deputy Assistant Secretary Caroline Casagrande attended the AIRC conference in Miami or Fort Lauderdale, and made the pronouncement there that Education USA, U.S. State Department, would now no longer prohibit its advisors from working with agents overseas. Obviously big news for anyone who's been in the business for more than a minute, knowing Education USA's policy. But now, the Assistant Secretary of State has said that international education is now the number one priority for her bureau, for the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. Well, hopefully that's more than just lip service to it. But yeah, apparently the address was very well received at this IIE summit, and that's she was quoted as saying, seeing more international students enroll into U.S. colleges and universities is the number one priority for our bureau. And that's important for her to say that because of the public diplomacy importance of international education, as well as the economic value that we all know about, with $42 billion impact positively in the U.S. economy because of the international, more than 1 million international students currently in the U.S. And those million plus international students support 450,000 jobs in the United States. So she referenced that in her speech, and it was very curious to hear her not only talk about the public diplomacy impact. She came up with a stat that I hadn't heard recently, and I knew that one of the priorities, obviously, with public diplomacy and bringing international students in is they go home and become leaders in their own country, in the economy and in politics, whatever it might be. But first time I've seen this article, this particular number, that international, that currently of all heads of state around the world right now, 58, or roughly a third, of world leaders receive their education, part of their education, in the United States as students. So that's significant. obviously, in terms of the soft power diplomacy that the U.S. has pursued over these years with bringing international students in. So it's not just Chinese that are doing it. We've been doing it for years as well. And what I think is important for her to say, Assistant Secretary Royce, is that something we've been talking about here for a number of weeks and months, is that, in her quote here, we face growing international competition to attract the world's globally mobile students. While we're already making great strides to respond to these new challenges, we must step up our game. I can't tell you how many times I've said that on this podcast and this on this live chat. It's so important that to realize that colleges and universities that have had international students for a while and have they may have come very easily to you, whether it was sponsored Saudi students or Chinese students that have been flocking to your institution because they were full paying students and your institution had a name brand, or even if it didn't, you've been lucky and you've gotten those students. You probably had to work hard to keep them, but certainly there are institutions that have had students come to their campuses without really having to try too hard. And now that it's getting increasingly competitive out there, not just because of politics in the United States, that has impacted slightly, but there are many more macro issues that are involved. And this competition piece is a significant part of that. What Canada has done to make their country more welcoming, what Australia is doing, what the UK is potentially doing now. There are other countries, other major destination countries, are more active internationally than we are. We have far more institutions than any other major player that is out there internationally, but we don't have really a coherent strategy nationally. I don't think we ever will, just because of the nature of the beast and how decentralized our higher ed structures are in the U.S. But it's also we're also in the situation here where until more institutions that are fighting for their survival have had, frankly, to rely on international students to bolster flagging domestic student populations coming to their institutions. Just had a call with a colleague in Chicago who he recently joined an institution in the last 2 years that had significant domestic student drops since 2008, and they have been able to rely on international students to bolster their and sustain their institution. And in fact, in the last 3 years, haven't had any drops and in their international student populations, which has helped sustain that institution. So those, and they're doing it right in terms of the diversification of where they're getting students from and all these other factors. But to have the Assistant Secretary of State make clear that they are committed to doing what they can and committing new funds to facilitating the enrollment of more international students in the United States. I think that's heartening in one regard, but it's also a warning to institutions that, hey, you got to step it up and you got to be more committed and more involved and more not only committed to enrolling a diverse number of students from more than just two or three source countries, but also committed to the services you're providing those students to make sure that you keep taking good care of them, not just get them on your campuses. So encouraging comments from the Assistant Secretary of State there for Educational and Cultural Affairs. So hopefully that's a sign of more positive things to come. So we'll see where that takes us. We'll finish today and we'll head back to the UK where we've talked about the impact of what a no-deal Brexit is going to mean for for UK universities, and it's hard to tell right now what the real issues are going to be. But certainly one it does look like a no-deal Brexit might be imminent. It might be brinksmanship at this point, but it might get pushed to the 12th hour, final hour of before the Brexit deal actually. Or Brexit actually happens at the end of the month. March 29th is the day. So we are 23 days out, a little over 3 weeks out from when this happens. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. One of the key aspects of a no-deal Brexit, what it means, what the way leading British universities have approached this, and I've just posted the link to that in the comments section. It's an article, again, from Inside Higher Ed, but it takes the tack from the British university stance, looking first to the Russell Group, and that's the 24 leading research universities in the UK. Their senior policy analyst, Joanna Burton, said, "We've said before, but it's worth repeating, that a no-deal Brexit is one of the biggest threats that our universities have ever faced." Now, she may be just speaking for the 24 Russell Group institutions, but what the challenge here is, and why no-deal Brexit matters to them, is because of research funding primarily, and work and study rules that affect EU citizens that might want to work in the UK moving forward. So after the March 29th deadline. So there are existing research funds through Erasmus Plus and Horizon 2020, nearly $90 billion worth of EU-wide funding programs that fund student exchange throughout Europe that help allow for, frankly, the larger volumes of EU citizens that have come to the EU, from the EU to the UK in the past, when it EU was, when UK was a member of the EU. And it's, frankly, that funding is a considerable chunk of institutional budgets. How much it directly impacts the Russell Group, I'm not sure, but in other universities outside the Russell Group that might be not as dependent on funding, frankly, probably are less worried. A colleague at Birmingham City University recently relayed that they're not really feeling the pinch in far as EU applications coming into their institution. They've had they've actually focused more of their time and effort on recruiting larger markets outside the EU, which have sustained them and will continue to. So they're not particularly as impacted by drops in EU students coming to their institutions. So it's important that there are two sides to the British University piece as far as no deal goes, but in terms of how there are actually scholars in the UK that say that it's actually not going to be that big of a deal. So that's it's interesting to see where there are calls for a second referendum to see if the British citizenry still wants to leave. It's a little late for that, I think. But there are some real challenges moving forward, obviously, if particularly with student flows. How the individual institutions are dealing with this as far as it impacts their institutional partnerships. Obviously, there are funding mechanisms that might be involved there that were maybe EU-dependent that maybe not allowed or not able to move forward if there aren't alternative sources of funding. So we'll be keeping an eye on this for you, and certainly interesting to see if on the EU institutional partnership front, if this means that more EU students as well, EU institutions as well as British University will be looking for other partners where they can send their students, perhaps funded students. So we'll be keeping an eye on this for you, and hopefully we'll have a little more clarity, certainly closer to the March 29th deadline. So probably won't be the last time we talk about this before Brexit happens, but certainly we'll look at how that progress or not. Lou, thanks for joining as well. Hope you're well, and hope you're dug out from all that snow you got up in the Northeast. Certainly, today's an important day, obviously, for institutions across the UK, in the US, as we look at our incoming classes for the fall, and not just this day, but to these days, and we look at where students are coming from, where the interest is, and how important it is at this stage with the students we do have. To be as flexible as we can and as attentive to the needs of those students as their deadlines, their final decisions come up for where they want to spend their time, whether it's in your institution in the U.S. or somewhere else abroad. That's increasingly what U.S. institutions are facing, so we'll be keeping an eye on that for you. And as we have other new developments in new markets, in old markets that might become rejuvenated, who knows what's happening. But there may be maybe other scholarships programs that will be popping up or renewed that might provide good resources or sources of students for institutions. So we'll keep you posted on those as things progress, and we look forward to having more conversations as the weeks go by. So thanks again for joining me today. For those who are needing the archive of these podcasts or these chats, You can look on the Facebook page if you'd like to see the video version of this that we're just doing today, as well as on our YouTube channel for SMIE Consulting. If you prefer podcasts, please catch up with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podbean, or Spotify. And you can find that using the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. If you do a search for that, you'll be sure to find us. So hope you all well and have a great week. And we look forward to chatting again next time. Cheers.